morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Baltimore City and the U.S. Department of Justice signed an agreement yesterday that, if it's approved in federal court, will mean sweeping changes in the way police officers do their work. The consent decree agreement follows a Justice Department investigation that found systemic problems in the department, ranging from illegal searches to inadequate investigations of sexual assaults to poor training. The report found that African Americans bear the brunt of these defects. This investigation followed the death of Freddie Gray, a young black man who died after being transported, handcuffed but not seatbelted, in the back of a police van. Speaking to reporters yesterday, U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said the aim of the reforms embodied in the consent decree agreement is threefold. Quote, to ensure effective and constitutional policing, to restore the community's trust in law enforcement, and to advance public and officer safety, end quote. Today we'll discuss those goals and whether the new agreement is likely to achieve them. The Reverend S. Todd Yeary, senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church, and Tara Huffman, director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at the Open Society Institute in Baltimore, are both here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
Good to be with you.
Reverend Yeary, Billy Murphy, the lawyer for Freddie Gray's family, called the consent decree a, quote, revolution in policing in Baltimore. Do you think it is that?
I don't know that I would call it a revolution. I think it's revolutionary in some senses, in that it creates a framework of mutual accountability for ensuring that policing, the protection of the constitutional rights of all of the people of Baltimore, is done the right way. Now, what's going to determine whether or not it becomes the act itself, the revolution, is going to be how it's implemented. This is the beginning of the work. How do we follow through and make sure that everything that is proposed in the consent is actually accomplished? And that's why we felt it was particularly important not to leave this as just kind of a conversation, but to actually get it documented. And I think for all of the work that went in to get it done in this time prior to the transition next week, I think all sides are to be commended for the effort that's been put forth. But this is just the beginning, as the Attorney General said.
I want to pick up on that timing in just a few minutes. But Tara Huffman, I mean, this consent decree is 227 pages long. It was released just yesterday. I don't expect that you have digested all of it. But what is your first reaction to it?
My first reaction, and I have spoken to colleagues who are familiar with other consent decrees in other jurisdictions, this is a rather comprehensive consent decree. The report that the DOJ released several months ago was a very comprehensive report. And I think that there are a number of people in the community who felt that it affirmed, that they felt very affirmed and validated in their grievances and the things that they have been trying to get the powers that be to pay attention to for a long time. The consent decree does a good job of addressing every single point that came out in that report. And we also find that the consent decree is very community informed, and that is not an accident.
What do you mean by community informed?
That this was not the DOJ, the city, and the police department sitting behind closed doors and coming up with a deal that just worked for the three of them. From the very beginning, during the investigation, right after the report, and even throughout the negotiations, different community groups, community leaders, civic leaders have gone to great lengths to communicate to the DOJ and all the parties involved what they want to see in this consent decree and the role that they believe the community must play in order for it to be implemented in a way that could be revolutionary for the police department and the city.
Just to pick up on your point about the investigation, the Justice Department reviewed hundreds of thousands of pages of documents dated from 2010 to 2015 before releasing that report last August. Some of what they found, black residents account for roughly 84% of stops, even though they represent just 63% of the city's population, 84% of police stopping pedestrians. 44% of the Baltimore Police Department stops were made in two predominantly African-American districts. And supervisors at Central Booking and local prosecutors rejected more than 11,000 charges made by Baltimore Police Department officers because they lacked probable cause or otherwise did not merit prosecution. Reverend Yeary, these are deep, longstanding issues. Do you think that a legal document like this consent decree will get to the heart of these problems?
I think it gives us an opportunity to begin to address them. And let's just be clear that the report actually identifies what they could track. Mm. There's also the unreported policing of communities that becomes a different problem. So what you get is kind of a survey of some of the symptoms that you're seeing, but not necessarily the full texture. So the consent decree.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but are you basically saying things are even worse than the Justice Department report laid out?
I think you're right. I think folks in the community would tell you. That was one of the things that caused them to cry out so significantly after Freddie Gray's death, is that, look, at the end of the day, there's what's reported, and then there's the rest of it. It's kind of Paul Harvey's old tagline. Now you know the rest of the story. I think we get a bit of the story in the report. I think what we do see is it gave everybody an opportunity to step up and say, look, we're better than this. We want better than this. And the people deserve better than this. How do we get there? Now, the consent actually takes it to a point where now the judge, the federal court, has a stake. And it now means that in order to get released from the consent, you have to satisfy it to the approval or the consideration of the court. That's a significant piece, so that if anybody fails in their implementation of what's in the agreement between the parties, there's now justification to go before a judge and say, look, judge, we need to get this corrected.
That's Reverend S. Todd Yeary of Douglas Memorial Community Church here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me is Tara Huffman, Director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at the Open Society Institute in Baltimore. We're talking about the consent decree reached by the City of Baltimore and the U.S. Department of Justice. President-elect Trump's nominee to head the Justice Department, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, has spoken skeptically, as you know, about the Obama administration's use of consent decrees to reform local police departments. 8 years ago, Sessions called consent decrees, quote, an end run around the democratic process, end quote. And, of course, that raises questions, some of the questions you've referred to, of how Baltimore's consent decree might be enforced going forward. Yesterday, I asked University of Maryland Law Professor Michael Greenberger, who heads the University Center for Health and Homeland Security, how he expects the consent decree to be enforced.
It will be lodged with a Maryland Federal District Court judge. And if the consent decree is embodied in a court order issued by that judge, then we'll have the power to order either of the parties, most pertinent the Baltimore City Police Department, to abide by the decree. And not only is the judge involved, but the decree specifies that a private expert monitor will be assigned to oversee the decree and to ensure that the reforms embodied in the decree are put into place.
So the case is already assigned to a federal judge, but it's not final yet. In fact, he's expected to hold a public hearing about what's in this decree.
So the judge will have to familiarize himself with it if he's going to embody it in a court order, because he's going to be the one who will be turned to if the decree in some sense collapses.
How long is that likely to take?
Well, historically, it's taken anywhere from a week to many months. My best guess is that this decree will become a court order before January 20th, 2017. I think a judge who is anywhere near the city of Baltimore knows the critical importance of getting the police department to operate in a not only constitutional way, but in a highly effective way. Crime is out of control here. It's hurting the economy. Businesses are thinking about leaving. Businesses don't want to come into the city. If we can get the crime rate down, if we can improve community relations, it is the first step in a renaissance for the city.
That was University of Maryland Law Professor Michael Greenberger. Tara Huffman of OSI, what's your sense? How important is it to get this locked in before Donald Trump becomes president?
It's very important, which is why we celebrate the fact that the consent decree was signed and filed with the court yesterday.
And does that lock it in?
As Professor Greenberger said, the court, it's not an order yet, and so there's nothing to be enforced yet. But you do have an agreement between the federal government and the city of Baltimore and the police department that these are the things that we are going to do.
It's essentially a contract.
It's a contract. And Benita Gupta, because I asked this question to her yesterday, said...
She's the head of the Civil Rights Division.
Head of the Civil Rights Division, absolutely. She said because it's a joint agreement between the two parties, it would be extremely difficult and highly unlikely that even if it wasn't a court order by January 20th, the time that President Trump took office, and Attorney General Sessions or Attorney General nominee Sessions were to take, it would be very difficult for them to undo it, because now it's sitting with the court and it's in the court's hands. I am hopeful with Professor Greenberg that this will actually be done by January 20th. The court has been giving a heads up. The parties have been doing what it is they need to do to get this to the court as soon as possible. They have requested a public hearing. And so there will be an opportunity for the public to comment on the consent decree before it becomes a court order.
On that point, help me understand. When I hear public hearing, I think of the kinds of thing that the city council does, for example. People come, people talk. That's not how I think of a judge having a hearing involving a court case. What kind of hearing is this going to be?
It will be held in the court. So there's not going to be a hearing at Morgan State or Coppin State or some
okay.
other public venue. It will be a court hearing, but it will be a public hearing. It won't be a private closed door hearing. And there will be opportunity for individuals to submit comments, particularly written comments. I don't know about oral testimony, but there would definitely be an opportunity for people to submit written comments and testimony to the court for the judge to consider as he's considering whether this decree is something that is fair, adequate, and there's another word that Vanita used.
Reasonable.
Thank you. Fair, reasonable, and adequate.
Well, Reverend Urie, so in this compressed time frame that you're both hoping on to get this more locked in a week, some kind of a hearing in court, I mean, is that really going to satisfy what I'm sure you're hearing in the community? I certainly am, too. People who, you know, they're all for this process, but they feel like, well, I don't think our view was fully represented. We didn't get to make all of our points. Is there any possibility that the public could still affect what is in this consent decree before it becomes a court order?
Right. So the consent decree kind of sets out principles, corrective principles, and what some of the targeted areas need to be. The specifics come out in actually doing the work. And so there's going to be ongoing opportunity, as was discussed in the briefing yesterday, for the community to continue to engage. As a matter of fact, you cannot have a successful satisfaction of a consent decree if the community is not a vital part of the participation process, to the point of the timing of trying to get the judge to affirm the joint petition. The reason we thought it was an urgent matter, and Mayor Pugh and the team and the folks from the police department and the Justice Department agreed, is because we don't have to imagine what a Republican attorney general would do around consent decrees of law that affect law enforcement. It has not been the practice. If you look at the numbers of actual investigations of police departments under any of the attorney generals under George W. Bush, you see few, if any, consent decrees. You heard it in the attorney general nominee's testimony the other day that he does not see consent decrees as actually being helpful. And when he says there's an end around the democratic process, constitutional policing is not a democratic process. It is constitutional policing. We don't need a vote on it. It's already established. And if it's not happening, then the court ought to be the place that assumes jurisdiction to make sure that all of the parties are accountable and that the executive branch, the police department, the city, do what it is that they are supposed to do by Constitution. This is not some negotiation to see what rights the people of the city ought to have. These are the rights that have already been violated by the police that need to be corrected. And now we have a framework that says police department, city, community, stakeholders, we're now all at the table. We now have the rules of how we're going to move forward. Now let's get to work and make this thing real.
And just to underscore before we take a quick break, Tara Huffman, you feel that framework basically is in place. There are still a few legal steps to be made, but it will not be affected by a change of ideology in Washington.
That is our hope. It would be very highly unlikely that anything that has been done thus far would be undone. And I think, yes, there are people in the community who the thing that they would have liked to have seen in the consent decree, that exact language isn't there. But I think that you'd be hard pressed to find a large majority or even large minority of people who would tell you, oh, absolutely, this is just unacceptable. Go back, do it again. No, everyone wants this to get done so we can move forward. And as Reverend Urie said, because the work is going to be in actually implementing what's in that consent decree. And there will be many opportunities for whatever didn't get articulated line by line, precept upon precept in the consent decree to happen during the implementation of the consent decree.
Okay, we need to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about this consent decree reached by Baltimore and the U.S. Department of Justice. I'm Sheila Cass. This is On the Record. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the consent decree agreement between the Justice Department and the City of Baltimore. The agreement was signed yesterday. My guests are Reverend S. Todd Urie of Douglas Memorial Community Church and Tara Huffman, Director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at the Open Society Institute in Baltimore. Tara Huffman, Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh says the focus of the reforms will be, quote, training, 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 close quote. Should that be the focus?
It should most definitely be a focus of the consent decree. Officers' behavior, conduct on a day-to-day basis, whether he or she is in the office or out on the street or in their patrol car, is governed by the training that he or she has received. The formal training as well as the informal training, because there have been anecdotal stories of officers who are told one thing at the academy, and then they actually get on the force, and their uplines tell them everything they taught you at the academy, that's not the way it works. Let me show you how it really works when you're here on the street. And so focusing on improving the training at the academy level, improving training at the in-service level, but then also making sure that that training actually translates into practice, that's going to be where the rubber hits the road. And so that's why I think the heightening, uplifting the importance of training, diversifying the training, and making the training more intense and more consistent across everyone within the department is going to be critical in helping to change exactly what is the practice that happens when you walk out of the training and what is the culture of the department after the training occurs. Because if there's no link between the training and the expectations of supervisors and superiors, and if there's no connection between the training and what I actually do in my job, both in terms of you evaluating my performance, holding me accountable when I don't follow what the training has taught me to do, providing the supports I need to implement the training that you just told me, all of that, it's all wrapped up together. So it can't be send officers to a classroom, let them sit down and for 40 more, 80 more hours, and then send them back into the street. No, there's a continuum that has to be adhered to, and it has to be training. And then how does that get translated into policy, into practice, into performance evaluation, into retention, into promotion, and into holding officers accountable?
And you make a strong case that training broadly defined it is tremendously important. I have, though, also heard people say, it's really more about hiring. I mean, I guess I'm really asking either of you if you want to, I mean, do you think officers who have been on the force for years can change their ways? Or are we talking about needing a new set of officers?
Well, I think the question is, how do you keep the system relevant and viable in real time? And so that's with your senior officers who have the experience in the field. You need them, but you also need new cohorts of officers coming into the profession. And so it's a both and. The training piece is particularly important because it makes sure that we never take the responsibility of the job for granted, because there's a great deal of power, because the state controls the legal use of force. That's a big responsibility to bear. And if we lose sight of the responsibility that comes with the authority, and that's only by way of training, to make, we've got body cameras coming online. What does that look like in terms of training? How does that affect interaction when we're dealing with crisis teams in the field? If there's a behavioral health challenge, how does that affect training? The dynamics of policing is ever evolving. And if we do not stay ahead of the curve and sharp in terms of the training and the tools that are given, then we're going to always have these kinds of episodes. The one thing that comes up very early in the report is there's also an opportunity and a role for the training and the engagement of the community in the oversight of their police department. And so one of the things that we've got to be ready to discuss, which has begun in Annapolis and is now open to local interpretation and implementation, is the participation of civilians on trial boards. We cannot have an ongoing accountability of discipline absent of participation of the very citizens who have a stake, a very high stake, in effective policing. This is not a gotcha moment. It is, we want the best police department, we want the safest city, we want the greatest investment, and you cannot have a department that's viable without relevant, credible civilian participation. And so the community has to be trained as well in terms of what goes with the job. What are some of the factors that we need to understand and appreciate in real time so that we can be a part to good policing?
The police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, have pointed out that that question of civilians on review boards is in their contract, and the consent decree does not supersede their contract. How do either of you see this being worked out?
Here's been my thought. They're in negotiations on the contract, and I'm speaking as a community advocate. Having been a labor guy, every other profession that has a great deal of responsibility has civilian participation. As a matter of fact, the Medical Accountability Board in the state has civilian participation that the requirement is the civilian on the licensure board for physicians. You cannot even have had any kind of medical training. Otherwise, it disqualifies you from holding the civilian seat. So this notion that somehow or other you have to have specialized insight to be able to be a police officer, I think, is counterintuitive when we look at how we apply it to other professions in the state. Now, that being the case, I would not sign off on any labor agreement in negotiation in light of this DOJ report that does not have civilian participation as part of the contract. And if we are at impasse, let's declare we're at impasse and send it to an arbitrator and let the arbitrator say, in light of what the Justice Department, the chief law enforcement body of the nation, has said, that we've got constitutional violations and the parties agree by way of the consent reading directly that community oversight is essential to rebuilding trust, we got to have a voting member on that trial board, and we got to have it now.
Tara Huffman, we have just a minute or so left, and I want to get to the point that Police Commissioner Kevin Davis made yesterday, that here in Baltimore, 318 murders last year. The BPD's homicide clearance rate last year was less than 40%, but Commissioner Davis says he believes that a crime fight and a reform effort can occur simultaneously. Tell us briefly how you see that happening.
Well, the two are inextricably linked. You cannot fight crime if you're an ineffective police department and if you're constantly engaging in unconstitutional policing. Officers, including Commissioner Davis, will tell you that one of the biggest problems they have in their clearance rates is that people don't come forward. Witnesses don't come forward. People don't show up for the court dates or the trial dates. You need the participation of the community to clear crime rates, and you need the participation of the community to help lower crime rates. And so when there is this extreme distrust, even fear, between police and the community, of course you're going to have a high crime rate. To talk about them as if they're two separate things is a fiction. You cannot divorce the two. You have to have community trust and effective policing in order to solve crimes and lower the crime rate. And so he's absolutely correct in the fact that he has connected to two and says it's imperative that we do both at the same time shows that, you know, he's the kind of leadership that, you know, we hope. You know, we're happy that he has signed on to this. We hope that he sticks around long enough for this thing to get some legs going, because that is exactly the kind of focus that the police department has to have. They can't just ignore crime and focus on the consent decree, but neither can they say, oh, we got to fight crime, and so we're going to ignore the consent decree. They have to do both at the same time.
We have to leave it there. I'm really grateful to you both for this conversation. Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Tara Huffman is director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program at the Open Society Institute in Baltimore. Reverend S. Todd Yeary is senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church. We're going to continue to look at details of the consent decree in coming weeks, and I hope you'll join us for that. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.